Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps even some insight into news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld, longtime Hudson Valley journalist, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Sir. Hello, Rex. Nice to see you.
Wonderful to see you also. And here from his private studios deep in the hills of Massachusetts, Dr. Alan Chartok.
Hello, hello, Josh Colonnet would say, hello, hello.
Hello, Josh Colonnet. Absolutely. Dr. Chartok has promised to speak only when we tell him to.
Yeah.
Nope, so, I didn't tell you. I didn't say.
Yeah, so we'll talk to you in about a half hour.
Right. No, what's happened, those of you who haven't heard, Alan unfortunately fractured an ankle, and so he's somewhat laid up. But fortunately, through the wonders of modern radio technology, there he is in the Berkshires, able to speak to us and hoping for a speedy recovery. Doctor, what's the prospect?
4 to 6 weeks. Anybody breaks anything, they look at you and you say, okay, doctor, how long? And they say, 4 to 6 weeks, always. It's universal.
Okay. Well, there you go.
4 to 6 weeks.
4 to 6 weeks.
What I don't know. I broke a glass in the kitchen once, and I could never use it again. So there's no four to six weeks with that.
All right. So, you think there's been anything going on with the news media?
No.
Yeah, I've been away for a while and haven't listened to a lot of programs, and I think there's been plenty to talk about.
Well, so here's this interesting notion. The president says that the media is the opposition party, that there's a war. Marty Baron, the Washington Post editor, the guy who was editing the Boston Globe at the time, depicted in the movie Spotlight, says, quote, "The way I view it is we're not at war with the administration. We're at work. We're doing our jobs."
I think the New York Times, the failing New York Times, as Trump says, and the Washington Post in particular, but others as well, have really stepped up. I mean, I read the Times every day in print and digitally, and I'm always pleasantly shocked to see how much coverage there is, how in-depth the coverage is. They're really going at this in every angle, and it shows what good journalism can do. I think the other thing is what Marty Baron, and we may disagree about this, Marty Baron is said, we're not at war with the administration, we're at work. And I agree with that, but I also can't imagine that given the comments that Trump has made about the dishonest media and the scum and et cetera, the fake media, that there isn't an extra little spring in the step of the reporters who are out there working to uncover what's going on with this guy.
Here's what I'm thinking, if anybody cares. But if the Republicans in the House and the Senate are dragging their feet on the investigations. You talk about spring in your step, Ira. Can you imagine that the people who are doing the oversight are not the Congress, which is supposed to be doing it, but the media? And they're doing a terrific job, as you say, so far, because a lot of what's coming out comes from the media. I'm astounded by how many sources they have. And remember, this is the same president who, when it looked like Hillary was going to win, and who, when Obama was the president, said he really believed in leaks. Well, he don't believe in leaks anymore.
That's correct. He was a great fan of WikiLeaks. He invited the Russians to go after Hillary's emails. I think that was humorous. But he liked leaks at that time. And now, and you know, the question about leaks is there are two points about that that are interesting. One of them is how differently you might feel about leaks depending upon your news source. It seems to me that if you are a regular viewer, an exclusive viewer, let's say, of Fox News, or if you read Breitbart, then you think that the issue facing the Republic right now is that the intelligence community is leaking. That's really how they are depicting the fall of General Flynn. Every other news organization is looking into and trying to find as much as they can about this question of whether there was some perhaps collusion between the Trump campaign and the Trump administration and Russia. And that is an issue that the intelligence community is concerned about. But that's not the way the story is depicted on Fox News.
But for all the talks of the leaks and for Trump's denouncing of the leaks, I don't know that anybody has suggested that the stories that have written about Flynn and others so far are incorrect. I mean, certainly he can denounce the leaks all he wanted, but he's the one who asked Flynn to leave. So he must have felt there was some credence to this information. Clearly there is credence. And all of these other questions out there regarding Trump and or his aides and Russia have still not been satisfactorily answered. They're not denying them, certainly. You know, if Trump did not have anything to do with Russia before or since his election, wouldn't you, if you were Trump, get up on the highest pedestal and declare that was the case?
Yes.
Yes. And not only that. Hello. Not only that, Sean Spicer. Now, that's an interesting one, right? Sean Spicer is, after all, the chief player of the press. He's the press secretary. He gets up there and he says, he fired him. He did the right thing. Flynn was bad. He fired him. And then Kellyanne, first she said, the president has complete trust in Flynn. Then he fired him. And now what's interesting is the president gets up the other day and says, you know what? Flynn's a wonderful man, and he's been misplayed by a lot of people and maligned by a lot of people. Now, which is it? Is it your people who are in charge of playing the press who are following orders, obviously? Or are you up there saying he's a really good man because he's going to be called to testify? He may, in fact, have to go before a jury at some point. And I think that maybe the president's a little nervous about what he'll say. So there you have this dichotomy between the people who are trying to play him for, you know, having to fire him, and at the same time saying he's a wonderful guy. What's that about?
Well, you know, it does show that this is an administration that is going in many different directions at once, that you can't really, as a reporter, keep track of it. One of the downsides of an undisciplined administration is that you don't really know what's going on. During the administration of Jimmy Carter, I worked in Washington at the time, back in the dark ages, but it was an interesting thing that the administration was very tight. There weren't a lot of leaks, and that was because people actually were working together. Hamilton Jordan, the chief of staff, and Jody Powell, the press secretary, actually were working together, and they were close to the president. They knew what he was thinking. In this White House, you have so many different centers of power that the press doesn't really know who to listen to. It makes it very difficult to really get a handle on what's going on, and so people leak to try to get their point of view across, but it may not always be accurate. So that's where you go with Kellyanne Conway saying one thing, that Flynn had the full confidence of Trump, and then the next thing you know, he's fired.
Well, you know, Trump keeps telling us how smart he is and that he uses the best words and what a smart businessman he is and was. But I think at the very least, to be kind to Trump, which is probably more than he deserves, he had no understanding of what the difference was going to be between running your own business, for which you're answerable to no one but yourself, and going to a government setting where you have these disparate departments and hundreds and thousands of government employees, not all of whom are going to agree with you and who are going to get their messages and their information out. And it's, I think it's overwhelming him. I mean, I don't blame him. If I went from the private sector running my company and where I could control what was coming out of my company and then went to a different organization where leaks, you know, were like a faucet, it would drive me nuts, because you're almost more interested in who's leaking than you are as to the substance of the leaks.
There's something else here, and that is the sense of constituency. Now, remember, Ira, you and I were having a pre-program discussion, and you raised the concept of Trump on the subject of anti-Semitism. Perhaps you could go into that for a second.
Well, I was struck by the press conference that he had with Netanyahu, which, by the way, occurred before they met, which was very odd. Normally, these leaders meet and then they come out because they have had at least a chance to discuss what might come up at the press conference. But at any rate, as you recall, if you saw the press conference, somebody got up and asked Trump about a surge in anti-Semitism since his election. And he had a wonderful opportunity to take that softball and hit it out of the park and denounce anti-Semitism. And instead, his fallback was, you know, I won the election with 306 electoral votes, and the people didn't think I was going to get more than 220. And it was the most circular, convoluted answer. And the only other reference to anti-Semitism in his answer was pointing to his daughter, who has converted to Judaism, and his son-in-law, who is very religious, and their grandchildren, the suggestion being, how could I be anti-Semitic when look what I have right here in the front row?
And my response to you was, when you said he could have hit it out of the park, I said he couldn't afford to hit it out of the park, and this has direct relationship to the way the media covers this, because the constituency that elected him may have large elements of anti-Semitism in, and he can't afford to tick them off because they're the ones he'll have to rely on to reelect them. And by the way, for some strange reason, he's just announced he's running again.
Oh, he filed almost immediately. Mm-hmm. There was you have to file some paperwork, and he filed right after he was inaugurated.
So that any fundraising he does will go right into that fund. You know, one of the interesting things about that press conference with Netanyahu is this: who the president called upon. Now, the ground rules are that each leader gets to call on two people from their respective national press corps. Trump, once again, went only to the right. He called on David Brody of the Christian Broadcasting Network and Katie Pavlich, the editor of townhall.com.
Never heard of that?
Right wing. No, of course not. And so there are all these hands waving, you know, of, you know, we all remember the press conferences where the president always nodded right to the senior White House correspondent. Helen Thomas of UPI at the time was for many years that person. But it's not that these people didn't ask interesting questions. The question about anti-Semitism was interesting. But the fact of the matter is, some of the most urgent questions of the day were not asked because
Rex,
goes only to the friendly people.
Well, Rex, let me ask you this, because one of our colleagues, and you know her very well, the investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo and professor of journalism at the University of Albany, has made the point maybe it's time to pull out the top people from the White House press corps because, you know, what are you doing, sitting on your hands all day? I disagreed with her. I think you have to be there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she's misunderstanding what the White House press corps is about. You can't be not there. And most of the major news organizations have multiple reporters. I think the New York Times has seven reporters in their White House team. And so it's not like they're all just sitting there. They're actually doing work relating to the White House. The White House is not just the president. It's a huge bureaucracy. And the reason that you're able to get leaks, let's say, is because all these reporters are working their sources. I would say that it's all the more important to be there. And you can't just skip the White House press briefings. That's not an appropriate response. The response is to keep doing the best you can. Not to walk away from it.
You know, the notion that he called on the two conservative journalists, and I believe that over the last three similar events, he's also chosen conservatives. So he's chosen six out of six. It would say to me, on the one hand, he's looking to find a friendly face and at the same time punish what he sees as his adversaries. But I'm also of the belief that he's afraid to ask questions or get asked questions by the bigger named organizations because he's not going to be able to handle them. I've come around on Trump on a number of different levels, but two in particular. One is I simply do not think he is a smart man. And the second one, and then it's a little bit more provocative, is I really am beginning to think he is unstable. But in terms of the former, I just don't think he is confident enough and is smart enough to realize that he can't handle some of these questions.
You know, that's such an interesting point you just made, Ira, about instability, because, you know, my doctorate is in politics and mental health, and appropriately, and I knew I was leaving you an opening, Rex, for your usual snotty hitback.
I would just say that if there's one person in this conversation who knows about mental problems, Alan would be that man. Go ahead, Alan.
No, I would definitely defer to you, Rex. However, I do think that there's been a spate of letters, including the Times as we speak today, from the top mental health people in America, saying, look, this guy, as Ira just said, this guy may be unstable, and we psychiatrists in the psychiatric community ought to be saying it. Yes. Now, the question for you guys on the media is whether or not the press should be reporting it because, you know, the association itself, the American Psychological Association, has rules against doing that kind of thing without seeing the person as a patient.
Yes, that is an extraordinary letter to the editor of the Times, signed by, I think, 36 psychiatrists. And they allude to the fact that they're violating the so-called Goldwater Rule, which restricts...
After Barry.
I guess.
Yeah.
Restricts what...
No, it was. It was after Barry.
Is
yeah.
that right? Because there was a lot of speculation.
I think so.
Running for president.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think I'm right about
And they're
that.
Not supposed to be doing
right.
that, they say, but they said the consequences of his mental instability are so extreme that we need to speak out. I think there has been some reporting in the past about questions about his mental stability, and certainly there has been talk about that in letters that you've read on this station, but I think that it's hard to do that reporting when most of the mental health community strictly adheres to this. We don't comment on people's mental health if we don't have personal examination.
Do you think in hindsight, or did you think at the time, that when they talked about Trump's temperament, that was a code word for his mental health?
I think it's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Because there was certainly a lot of discussion about that throughout the campaign.
Right. Well, there was talk about the severe narcissism, you know, about that being all of the signals are there for intense narcissism. Yes, Alan?
But you guys are dancing around my very good question, which is, would you do it in your newspaper? I mean, if, let's say, the Albany Psychiatric Association, if there is such a thing, got together and said, we condemn Trump or Cuomo or anybody else. We think he's a narcissist or crazy. Would you put that on the front page of your paper?
Yes.
Yeah, if the organization or individual had standing, by all means.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Here's Ira Fussfeld from the Daily Freeman of Kingston and Dr. Alan Shartok in the Berkshire Hills, relaxing, probably has his foot up, you know, just hanging out there. And
I just took it down. It hurt too much.
Oh,
yeah,
so
go
sorry.
Ahead.
Actually, I'm sorry. Anyway, one more thing about leaks before we go on, and that is that leaks come, generally speaking, to those who are working for them. Leaks don't usually just get delivered on a silver platter. They come because people have been working their sources and saying, what do you know about this? What do you know about this? For example, Andrew Puzder, the guy who got taken down.
How did you pronounce that?
I'm not sure. But he's the guy who was supposed to be the Secretary of Labor, the guy who put on the commercials with the big burgers.
Yeah, Carl's Jr. and Hardee's.
Yeah. So anyway, Puzder basically lost support among Republicans in Congress as a result of Politico reporting. Politico got its hands finally. There was opposition building, but they got their hands on a tape from an Oprah program in the 1980s in which his estranged wife talked about being beaten by him. She subsequently took that back, but this wasn't just delivered up to Politico. This reporter for Politico, Mariana Levine, searched through a private archive. She spent 2 months trying to find this videotape and finally found a VHS tape and a place to play it, amazingly enough. So a lot of times it is really dogged reporting that yields leaks, not just a reporter sitting back waiting for somebody to come in.
Well, I have something to say about that. Hello. And that is this. There are reporters, you say you have to work for these things. That's a good example that you've just given. But there are also reporters who are known for using stuff no matter what. So there are some reporters you go to and you say, okay, I got a story that some major political official was making out with his press secretary on the floor. And the question then becomes, do you use it? There are some people who no matter what you bring them will use it. Some of them are even retired now. And so the question is, do you have to work to establish a relationship as a user so that some people will know if I give this piece of filth or whatever else to the reporter, they're going to use it?
I guess that's one tactic. You know, if you'll use anything somebody gives you, I guess that's one way to get people to give you more.
But, well, that's called the New York Post, P-O-S-T.
I knew who you were aiming toward, absolutely. The fact of the matter is, actually, I heard a reporter the other day. I was on a panel with a very good international freelance writer who said, I develop sources before I need to call upon them. And she talked about how much
absolutely
work she does to get to know people and to talk to them and to listen to them before she actually has to ask them questions. And that's where leaking comes through. and where it works. And you know, it's interesting that the president is saying, oh, leaking is un-American. I mean, leaking is very American. I mean, you consider the Pentagon Papers, consider Iran-Contra, consider the diplomatic and military material that Chelsea Manning disseminated via WikiLeaks, the Panama Papers. I mean, there is a lot of material that has gotten out that we know about the world and about how our government operates because of, let's call them, leaks.
And to the extent that Trump and his people are calling the media the opposition party and are denouncing virtually anything that is reported that they don't like, that seems to me all about laying the foundation for people to not believe them, even when their stories are accurate. And so when these leaks come out, and the leaks that are not going to be favorable to the Trump administration, he'll be able to stand up and say, you can't believe that stuff.
Mm-hmm. But a very good point that Rex makes about the preparation. You know, the real good ones will call you until you say you see their name on the phone and you don't want to talk to them because, you know, it's just enough already. But they work you, and they work their regular sources, and they go back and forth and say, what do you got for me today? Or, you know, sometimes it's just how the kids. And that's what sets the stage for when you have to go to somebody. You go to that automobile salesman as opposed to another one.
Mm, yeah, that's surely true. By the way, there was a moment of apology that we need to make note of. A New York Times reporter at apparently a social event during New York Fashion Week made some comment about Melania Trump, referring to her as a hooker. Subsequently was disciplined by the New York Times and apologized. That reporter is Jacob Bernstein, the son of Carl Bernstein and Nora Ephron. He's a features writer. He's not a political writer. He made what he calls a stupid remark in what he thought was a personal conversation. The lesson is there is no such thing as a personal conversation if you're a journalist or a politician.
You bet.
Yep. So he apologized. He said, my mistake referring to unfounded rumors shouldn't reflect on anyone else, and I apologize profusely. So that
did he get fired?
No, he did not. Again, it was and I think that's a close call, actually. But the questions about her behavior before meeting Donald Trump have been out there. You know, she's got a $150 million defamation suit pending against the Daily Mail for publishing a story claiming that she was a paid escort before she met Mr. Trump. So it's not as though that's an entirely new bit of conversation. So I think that's probably why he wasn't fired, but it was quite inappropriate, obviously, and the Times responded very quickly with a reprimand, and he with an apology.
By the way, Carl Bernstein is doing some tremendous work for CNN and another organization on this Trump business, so he's been dogged. He has not forgotten his roots.
Yeah, good thing.
Or as Kellyanne Conway would say, Bernstein was counseled.
He was counseled. He was counseled, yes. Kellyanne Conway, who, by the way, your friend Joe Scarborough, Alan. Joe Scarborough.
Yeah. Him I don't like. I don't like him. Yeah.
He says that she's a liar. And you know, he's been called the Trump whisperer. They say that the president talks to him. And he says everybody in the White House but Donald Trump has complained for months that she's a free agent. She goes in and does stuff on her own. So there you go. We'll see. There is more, much more on all these stories, and I guess we'll have to come back to it, Ira, right?
I'll be around.
All right. Alan will be there taking it easy in the Berkshires.
How long is it going to be out? 6 weeks?
Tell us again.
Four to six. But I'll be there. Eat your hearts out, guys.
I'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us on the Media Project.
They all got tired of patches on their pants.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Rosemary Armeo is the director of the Journalism Program at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.